Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Patrick Francis Moran was born in Ireland in 1830. Long before he would become Australia's first Roman Catholic cardinal, he was a student in Rome when the nationalist movement of 1848 was threatening the temporal power of the Church. The Arc this week on ABC Radio National focuses on the man who the Daily Telegraph dubbed the Prince of the Church. It was meant to be a snipe, but it was close to the truth. Moran was a kind of student prince, an accomplished medieval scholar with impeccable ecclesiastical family connections and a well-heeled background. He conducted himself with the full authority of the Church and was quick to stem any threat to his power. Philip Ayres has just written a new account of his long and eventful life.
Moran exaggerates the extent of what he calls the terror in this period. He doesn't really present in his diaries and in his letters a very objective view of that revolution. It's very much coloured by the institution that he belongs to and their self-interest as it was affected by that revolution.
Is that why he wasn't attracted to revolution in his homeland of Ireland? He wasn't exactly at the barricades for home rule.
He wasn't. Later, he moved in that direction very strongly. When he came to Australia, for example, he took up an Irish nationalist position that was reported in the Irish press and which really surprised the people who'd known him before he came to Australia.
But, well, he was at a safe distance.
He was at a safe distance then. And also, I think he realised that his Irish Catholic constituency in Australia, they'd moved strongly in this nationalist direction. Even when Moran was Bishop of Kilkenny in the 1870s, early 1880s, before he came to Australia, he was moving in the nationalist direction. But I think he had an inbuilt suspicion, abhorrence of violent revolution. There was a movement called Young Ireland, then there were the Fenians, these sort of people who later fed into the IRA. Moran was troubled by this sort of revolutionary tendency. He wouldn't, for example, ever have, if he'd lived longer than he did, he died in 1911, he wouldn't have taken a pro-IRA stance like Archbishop Mannix in Melbourne did.
Well, I got the impression Moran preferred to take up his own fights, and he certainly got into a few of them. When he was in Ireland, he had a very public conflict with the parish priest Father O'Keefe. What did this affair tell you about Moran's character?
It told me that Moran tended to polarise issues. In what he wrote about Father O'Keefe, who really led a schismatic movement there in a major town in the diocese, what Moran writes about this man in his diaries and his letters suggests that he almost sees the man as under a satanic influence. This is typical of the way in which Moran views people who take a position of opposition to the sort of central authority of the Church.
He was very much a centralist, and one has to remember that in 1870, the doctrine of papal infallibility was introduced, and I gather Moran was a supporter of that.
Yeah, he was there at that First Vatican Council in 1870 with his uncle, the Cardinal Archbishop of Dublin. They were talking about the way in which you define this concept of papal infallibility that a majority of the delegates wanted to pass. There was a strong minority who were opposed to it. It's a doctrine that the Catholic Church had accepted without defining for quite a few centuries. The idea that the Pope, that under certain defined conditions, his edicts are infallible. It goes back to a statement that Jesus made that he would send the Holy Spirit after he ascended to heaven, and the Spirit would lead you into all truth. But they were having trouble at that meeting in actually finding words to articulate this notion that would satisfy a majority of the delegates. And it was actually Moran, from the evidence that I've seen, who came up with the form of words which he then gave to his uncle, who, in an address to the council on the subsequent day, suggested as the appropriate words, which were then accepted by the council.
Well, Well, Patrick Moran's connection to Australia was at first at a long distance when he was the non-residential vicar general to the Bishop of Maitland, I think, in 1867. But by the early 1880s, he was appointed Archbishop to Sydney. Do you think he relished the post?
I think the post that Moran really wanted was the position of Archbishop of Dublin. His uncle had died in the late 1870s, and Moran had tried to get himself into that position using influence. He's a very ambitious man. He had failed. He had too many enemies within the hierarchy of the Irish Church. When he was offered the position in Sydney, I think he realised he was never likely to get the position in Dublin. So he came out to Sydney as a kind of second best.
What did he think were the challenges for him here in Australia?
The sort of challenges that he faced included the fact that the Catholics here were in a minority who was looked down upon by a wealthier Protestant ascendancy. So the challenge was to defend the interests of that minority, particularly in relation, for example, to the rights to develop their own educational system, but to stand up for them in the attacks that they often suffered from radical Protestants of an Orange or Northern Ireland character.
I gather he also wanted to green the church here. It was really the greening of the Catholic Church when he came.
That's right, Rachel. Prior to Moran, the leadership of the church in Sydney was English by background. Moran was the first Irish Archbishop of Sydney, and overwhelmingly his Catholic constituency were Irish, must be something like 96-98% of them.
I guess that's why they gave him such a warm welcome. I think you mentioned in your book 6,000 parishioners were in the cathedral?
Were in the cathedral, and something like 60,000-80,000 out on the harbour watching him come in on the ship. So it was really the Irish in Sydney responding to one of their own who was taking over a church. There had been a lot of resentment against the fact that they had not had an Irish archbishop up to that point. And so there was a relief that he was a man who was going to, as you say, colour the church green. And he did that with a vengeance.
Well, speaking of vengeance, and I should just say that was in 1884, when he came. Well, it wasn't long before he threw his weight around, was it? I mean, he fired the rector of St. John's College.
That's right.
He dismissed the inspector of schools, who was a layman, and he caused a mutiny of doctors at St. Vincent's Hospital because they weren't Catholic.
Yeah.
He was certainly not a man to get on the wrong side of.
He wasn't. He was a man who was ruthless with people he perceived as his enemies. To take the St. Vincent Hospital case, he regarded, I don't know on what evidence, but he must have had some evidence pointing in this direction, he regarded the doctors of the hospital as a Freemasonry ring, a kind of Protestant Freemasonry ring. And he determined to get rid of them.
Well, he would also make a mark for himself in another way, in a fairly positive way, as a builder.
Yes, indeed. And this is a major achievement, that he built so much in Sydney, expanded the church physically, without putting it in a debt. But he was responsible for probably half of what we see of St. Mary's Cathedral today in terms of raising the funds for it or actually building it. He built St. Patrick's College out at Manly, which, if you've seen it, it's a major institution physically. A whole lot of churches, expanded hospitals like St. Vincent's, expanded the number of priests, multiplied, I think, the number of teachers something like fivefold. But yes, it was a great period of expansion of the church in the Sydney area and in New South Wales beyond.
Well, I gather the new Archbishop Moran wasn't too impressed by the caliber of Catholic priests in Australia. He thought that sort of the second best came here. Is that why he was so keen to establish a seminary, St. Patrick's Seminary at Manly?
Precisely. There really hadn't been a major seminary operating in Australia before he established that seminary. And he was concerned that bishops in Ireland were using Australia as a kind of dumping ground for bad priests. So if he could establish a seminary and get his own priests through there, he could sort of keep an eye on them, make sure the quality was lifted.
You mentioned that Patrick Moran was really aiming to get that Dublin post, and of course he didn't get it. When he went to Rome, hoping that there might be a chance he would become the Archbishop of Dublin, he didn't get it, but the Pope made him cardinal instead. Yes. Was that a sort of consolation prize?
I think so. The Pope had in mind to make Moran Archbishop of Dublin in 1885, just after the preceding cardinal died. The Pope was under a lot of pressure from the English government to put into that post somebody that the English government felt they could work with. In other words, somebody who was not really strongly nationalist. And they saw Moran at that stage as somebody who was a reasonable kind of guy from their point of view. So they put a lot of pressure on the Vatican, particularly on the Pope, to have Moran appointed to that position. A cable was sent off to Moran in early 1885, come to Rome as soon as you can. And Moran rightly, you know, expected that he was called to be offered this position. You don't get called to Rome to be appointed a cardinal. But in the meantime, during the voyage over there, the Pope and the College of Cardinal people decided that they couldn't force Moran onto the Irish hierarchy, that he was too unpopular there, that there'd be all hell to pay if they did what the British government wanted. When he got off the boat at Naples to come up to Rome, he was told on getting off the ship that he wasn't going to Dublin, that he was going to be appointed a cardinal instead. So it was a consolation prize.
And that's how Australia got its first cardinal.
That's correct. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, he certainly liked wearing his robes. There's a wonderful image in your book in which he's invited to a tea party for the Anglican Synod, and he appears in his full robes.
That's right. He certainly took a high profile publicly on behalf of his church, and that just typifies that approach.
Well, you said he was ambitious. He was also quite politic, because in Australia, he did make sure that he had friends amongst high-class Protestants.
Yes.
Which is ironic, because his old nemesis, O'Keefe, in Ireland,
O'Keefe had a lot of friends among Protestants, including
true.
The British House of Commons.
Well, he certainly castigated O'Keefe for having Protestant friends.
Yes, he did.
The weeds of the Pope's garden, he called them.
That's right. But Moran, in Sydney, Moran cultivated friendships. I wouldn't say he sort of went out of his way to cultivate them. To some extent, they were mutual friendships, but he had friendships with the political leadership in New South Wales right from 1884 when he first came out here through to 1911 when he died. Across the range of parties, he had personal relationships with people, particularly strong with the Labour Party, but also with, say, the free traders, for example. Moran was not a deeply prejudiced man. What he articulated to his flock, he articulated the position of the magisterium, the teaching magisterium of Rome. He presented the truth of the Catholic religion as had been presented to him. But in his personal relationships, you know, he was a broad-minded man, I think.
Well, he could be surprising, and no more so as an advocate of federation, and also an advocate of remaining linked to the British crown. He wasn't vying for independence of Australia, which is interesting.
He wanted to see Australia as a federal nation. He wanted to see a federal government. But he saw Australia as continuing its links with the British Empire. Moran actually stood for election to the federal convention, which drafted the final version of the constitution, the convention of 1897 to 98. 10 delegates were to be elected from each of four colonies. There were something like 50 candidates in New South Wales. He stood for election. He polled number 14, so he didn't get elected. But it's highly interesting that the leading ecclesiastic in Sydney should stand for an election to a body like that. It wouldn't be allowed. The church wouldn't allow it today.
When he died in 1911, what was the kind of reaction from the religious establishment across the board?
Well, you know, there were the normal expressions of condolence and sympathy, but they probably came more fulsomely from, for example, the Jewish community. The chief rabbi, Moran had established very warm relationships with the chief rabbis in Sydney, and they regarded him as a good friend. So there was probably a warmer relationship, I would say, between Moran and the Jewish community in Sydney than there was between him and, say, the Anglicans or the Presbyterians or the Methodists.
Philip Eyre's book is Prince of the Church, Patrick Francis Moran. Cardinal Moran's relationship to the rabbis of Sydney foreshadows tonight's Spirit of Things, which focuses on Christian-Jewish relations. That's tonight after the news at 6. The Arc next week talks to the former diplomat Tony Kevin about the history of medieval pilgrimage and his book Walking the Camino. That's on The Arc with me, Rachel Kahn.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.